From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the program, it's been cold and snowy, but is this winter's weather actually unusual? Later, what patients might get out of access to their doctor's notes about them. Why a derelict library on the city's north side is the perfect place for public art.
Finney Library used to be the beginning of the imagination of the Sherman Park and Washington Park community. Anyone that grew up around that neighborhood has a story of studying there or maybe falling in love there or whatever. It was a hub.
And sports contributor Howie Magner on why ticket sales have been slow for a Packers playoff game.
I think you combine the weather with maybe people not necessarily believing that the Packers are going to win the game. I think there's just a lot of things that are working against it.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Two things have captured the attention of many Wisconsinites this week: winter weather and the Packers' playoff chances. We'll talk football with our sports contributor later in the show. But first, after a frigid night last night, the forecast calls for even colder weather early next week, with temperatures climbing no higher than 9 or 10 below on Monday. Meanwhile, yesterday afternoon sunshine gave snowplows the chance to finally catch up with the task of clearing the roads. It's been a winter that longtime Wisconsin residents say is reminiscent of winters past, but is that really the case? Ed Townsend is a meteorologist with a National Weather Service office in Sullivan, and he's on the line with us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We are just out of December, the first month of winter. The first couple of days of January have been pretty eventful as far as the weather goes. How extreme has this winter been in southeastern Wisconsin in terms of both temperatures and snowfall?
In terms of our winter so far, it's been pretty normal, actually. Just looking in December, we were only around 4 degrees below our normal average high temperature. Same with our low. You're around 7 degrees below our normal low temperature for the month. And as far as precipitation is concerned, we are running low on that too, with only an inch and 79 hundredths of precip. Snow-wise, we were running a little bit, or quite a bit, above normal, 19.3 inches at the end of the month, around 8.7 tenths. Above normal.
So let me interrupt there. We're running above normal in terms of snowfall, but below normal in terms of precipitation. The normal average December would have more rain in it? Is that why the difference would be there?
Not necessarily. A lot of it has to do with the actual liquid content of the snow. So we've just been having the snow that has been falling has had more of a dry snow, it's been more of a dry snow. So it's a higher snow to liquid ratios.
Let's talk about the concept of normal. How far back do you go in terms of assessing what a normal winter is versus what we're actually having?
For the actual climate period, we use a 30-year cycle, and so currently we look at 1981 to 2010, but the actual record period for Milwaukee actually goes back to 1871.
So let's talk about the long term. I mean, the line that we hear a lot from people around here, at least people who grew up in this area, is that this is what winter used to be like around here. How true is that? Is this a case of, you know, what's been normal for the past few years hasn't necessarily been normal for the longer term?
You know, most recently it's been pretty similar in the last couple of years as far as temperatures have been concerned. For instance, we have a forecast of 10 below zero as the low temperature. That just hasn't happened the last 4 years. But actually going back into the 90s, 80s, and 70s, that wasn't infrequent. It would happen around at least once or twice a year on average.
So this is the case for the people that are saying that this is what weather used to be like in December and January. That really was the case in the 90s and 80s and 70s even.
That's correct.
Well, so tell us about the deep freeze that's apparently setting up to join us early next week. What are the conditions that are coming together to make that happen?
Well, what's really coming together is we have this nice, strong cold front coming out of Canada, as well as a very cold air mass. the air mass, as far as when we look aloft at around 850 millibars, is very cold, about approaching and exceeding two standard deviations. So what we're seeing is this is a fairly rare, not unprecedented, but it's pretty extreme.
Well, right. How unusual is it in the area, in this area, to have high temperatures that are topping out below zero? Because that's what we're talking about for Monday and maybe even Tuesday, right?
Yeah. And like you said, you know, recently we haven't seen that, but it's not completely uncommon. For instance, in Milwaukee, we're forecasting low temperatures to be below zero almost 2 days in a row. Last time we've had a streak of high temperatures less than 0 degrees in Milwaukee was in 96. Overall, this has happened 18 times.
But not since 1996.
Yes.
What do we know about the timing of that cold air mass? How long is it likely to settle into the area? And what will make the difference in terms of it moving through and leaving?
It'll be coming in the area Sunday night, but it's actually going to linger into Tuesday, perhaps longer. Once we start getting 5-7 days out, the forecast becomes more difficult.
Does the amount of snow on the ground have an influence on the air temperature?
Yes, it does. It can make it feel a lot colder.
So when we're talking about, and I think the forecast right now is that the high temperature on Monday might be 9 below zero, it could feel even more than that or even less than that?
Well, it will feel that. The real impact is going to be wind chills. Once we start adding wind to the mix, what it actually feels like outside will actually feel a lot colder. Sunday night, Monday morning, we're forecasting wind chills 30 to 35 below zero. And then Monday night, Tuesday morning, near 40 below zero.
Well, and so then presumably this is when wind chill advisories come out. What is the threshold for when you start sending out precautions about air temperature and wind chill temperature?
And that's the other thing, too, is, you know, 5 days out, when we get that far out, we really don't issue a wind chill product yet. But wind chill watches and warnings will likely be needed given this forecast. The criteria for wind chill advisory, for instance, is 20 below to 34 below zero with winds at least 4 miles per hour. For wind chill warning, you're looking at wind chills 35 below or colder with similar wind speeds of 4 miles per hour or more.
Well, and I know when you put out like severe thunderstorm warnings and tornado watches and warnings, there's kind of a statement that goes along with it explaining what the situation is. What is the precaution that you suggest that people take when we talk about wind chill temperatures that are that low?
You really got to dress appropriately for the cold weather. You know, wear layers, loose-fitting clothing, lightweight, wear a hat, and try to stay dry and out of the wind. If you're traveling, have a car kit with all the necessary safety items in case, you know, something was happening and you're actually stuck out there on the road.
There is an irony, or at least maybe, I don't know if irony is the right word, but between now and Monday and Tuesday, there's going to be kind of a brief warm-up period. Is that right?
Yep. Friday, we're going to actually see us peak into 20 degrees.
And on the weekend, I gather maybe approaching 30?
Yep. Saturday right now, the forecast is for 32.
There is, I know, a chance of snow between now and then as well. We have had some lake effect snows this winter. How common are lake effect snows on this side of the lake?
It's not rare or uncommon, at the least. It's very conducive, and depending on what kind of situation we have, we really need the winds to be coming out of the northeast and east to get some lake effect snow.
So as of now, the best information is that the high temperature on Monday will top out at 9 degrees below zero. Let's flash back. What was the temperature on January 6th, 2013?
2013, on the 6th, our high temperature was a balmy 35.
And so I guess as a meteorologist, the silver lining would be that this is a time when meteorologists don't actually have to go outdoors to take climate readings?
Yes. All our co-op observatories have electronic instruments.
Ed Townsend, thank you so much for helping put it in perspective.
No problem.
Stay warm.
You too.
Ed Townsend is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Sullivan, Wisconsin. You'll find a link to this year's climate data from Milwaukee from WUWM.com/lake effect. Why an area hospital system is giving its patients access to their doctor's notes. That story when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. With the information age has come a revolution in medicine. Doctor's notes, those sheaves of paper which used to be exclusively handwritten and placed in a thick manila folder and giant file cabinets, are now electronic. At the same time, the internet is connecting people to their care team and to more medical information than ever before. A local hospital system is marrying those two phenomena. Columbia St. Mary's has recently launched a system called Open Notes, which gives its patients access to everything their doctors write down during a patient visit. Dr. Bruce McCarthy is an internist and president of the physician division at Columbia St. Mary's, and he's with us in the studio. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Why do you think this is an important step? Why was this concept called Open Notes important for you and the Columbia St. Mary's system to be a part of?
I think it's important for patients. It's been something that's been going on for a couple of years. Other systems have tested it, and they had great patient satisfaction. Patients felt much more involved in their care, and it's something that we felt we wanted to do for them.
Well, and so let's talk about the other side of the coin, if you will. What was lacking? Why was this needed? What was not there that this fills that particular niche?
Well, let me tell you a story. And why I'm sort of a big fan of this and kind of passionate about it is as my mother was getting older and she was developing a little cognitive impairment, she would go and see her doctor, who happened to be one of my best friends, and then I'd call her when she got home and say, "What'd Rick say?" And she said, "Everything was fine." And I knew that everything wasn't really fine, and so I could call up my friend and say, "Hey, what's going on with my mom?" And I thought I had that kind of access into what the doctor is really thinking about my mom, and I thought everyone should feel like they have that kind of access to their parents' records in this case, or to their own records.
So that's another aspect of this. This is not just patients being able to access doctor's notes, but it's caregivers as well.
I think that's a big part of it, you know, and there's many, many studies that show that the patients literally remember about 50% of what they hear in a visit. And so to be able to, for a caregiver to read all the details and help their parents along or help other family members along is a big deal, I think.
I think most of us as patients or relatives of patients have heard about the concept of doctor's notes. You see doctors typing things up all the time. And knowing a few doctors myself, I know that they often go and do notes later on. But what's there? What is in doctor's notes that people will now have access to?
Well, for most of us, I think, in Milwaukee area, most of us have summaries after the clinic visit that patients get, and we'll have their medications and their next appointments and maybe a couple of instructions and things like that. This goes more into the doctor's notes and recording of what we're thinking. So it might say back pain. It tells a little more what I'm thinking. I think this isn't serious. I think we'll treat it conservatively. I think we'll watch for 6 weeks. If we need to do something more, we'll order an MRI. Or it might say, "I'm a little concerned about this back pain. The man is older. He's been losing weight. I'm concerned there might be something more serious. I think it's important to get an MRI right away." And so then people can read and be sort of a privy to that kind of detail and be intimate with what we're thinking.
Would you expect or be concerned that doctors might write their notes any differently, knowing that they'll be read by an audience beyond other medical professionals?
You know, it's interesting. This study that was done, they looked at around 95 doctors and asked them that question, said, "Do you write it differently?" And a lot of them didn't. But some of them did. Somewhere around 20% of doctors said, "Yeah, I describe things a little differently. I might describe obesity differently. I might describe the possibility of cancer a little differently so that I don't alarm people too much." So there is a little bit of that I think will go on.
Well, and you wouldn't, though, think that's inhibiting at all?
I don't think it's inhibiting. It's not inhibiting for our sort of thinking process or our diagnostic pathway, you might say. I don't think it will be at all. I think it will help patients know that we're concerned, but we're trying to not alarm them at the same time. So as an example, if I saw a chest x-ray and there's a little something on us, probably a scar, not a big deal. In the past, I might say low probability of malignancy, repeat in 3 months. Now I might say abnormality on chest x-ray, likely scar tissue. We'll repeat in 3 months to rule out anything more significant. I still know that there's a small chance that there's a cancer. Probably not. But that's something I would, you know, not alarm them with but still follow up on.
What about the idea of, for lack of a better word, a glossary? Doctor's notes are typically written for the sake of the doctor and other medical professionals, and sometimes they're complicated, and they might use complex terminology or unfamiliar acronyms or abbreviations. How likely is it that there are going to be things in the notes that the patient just simply, you know, don't get without some additional context?
I think that's a great question. Far fewer than I would have predicted. So in the study they did, it was about very roughly about 5% of patients thought were confused or concerned or something by what was written in the note. With now with the internet and Google and all that, people can Google, you know, all of our abbreviations and quickly they'll know exactly what we're talking about. So I think and when they don't, then I think they discuss them at a visit, and that's exactly what you want them to be talking about.
Is there some risk of having patients who are not necessarily trained in medicine playing armchair quarterback, if you will? We talk about the Googleization of medicine, and I know that there have been concerns about, you know, simply things as easy as, you know, TV commercials for drugs, and patients come in and they say, well, you know, they said to ask my doctor about Plavix or whatever. Does this play into that cycle as well?
I think there is that cycle. I know a lot of people worry about it. In fact, now I've taken to asking patients, are there things you've thought about or looked up that maybe you're worried about? Kind of opening the door to them. It's happening already. I don't think this makes it any more likely. If anything, it might help the patient know we've thought about that, or we don't, you know, you might put in your note, you know, doubt significant pathology or doubt something, and they'll know that we're thinking about it. I think that door has already been opened. Patients are walking through it. I don't think this will make it worse. Might make it a little bit better. Might have no impact.
Walk us through how the system itself is working.
Well, first you have to get a password to get onto the portal. And so for like most of the health systems in Milwaukee now, you log in. You can see your problem list, your medication list, your vaccinations, labs, all your recent labs. Those little summaries we give at the end of the visits, instructions, follow-up instructions, you'll see those too. And then there's another tab on our portal that says doctor notes. And then you'd go in, you'd find the visit, the date of your visit, and then you'd open it up and you'd see exactly what I see. You'd see what we call the HPI or history of present illness. And that's when I take a little, that's the questions we ask, and then we turn it into a little story or summary. And then at the bottom, there's, you know, the physical exam will be documented and other things. Then at the bottom, that's what we call the assessment and plan. And someone will say or see, number one, this problem, what I'm thinking about it, what we plan to do. Number two, this problem, and et cetera.
What about feedback or follow-up? You read something in your doctor's notes. You have a question about it. How easy is it to find out the answer?
You can call the office. You can make an appointment. But new for us, relatively speaking, is that you can email your doctor or the doctor's team now and send a message in, hey, I'm wondering about this. What do you mean or what do you think I should do? And then if it's something simple that we can answer, we just would answer it. If it's more complicated, I'm concerned about the workup of whatever, great, make an appointment. We can talk about it and maybe reexamine the issue.
This seems like just another part of the changing dynamic, this notion of people being really their own healthcare advocate or an advocate for the person for whom they're caring.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it is surprisingly, it didn't cause more questions than it did in the study. And a few doctors in the few percent range said their visits were a little longer. They got a few more phone calls or messages or things like that. But by and large, not. People would usually take care of it at the next visit. It was usually, from what I can gather, reinforcing for what they had heard at the visit and not something new, and so not something that would generate a lot of questions. But it does put the patient in control. I mean, it gives them a lot more control, probably, is a better way to put it.
Are doctor's notes from visits that happened before this system went into place, are they available now? Are they going to be available in the future?
Well, it's interesting you should ask, because we had quite a debate among the physicians about whether we would do this or not. There's a lot that said, no, it will worry them, it will cause confusion, it will lead to a lot of questions that don't even really need to be asked. And so there's a lot of debate. And even some said, my notes are shorthand, they're jargon, they're really not ready for prime time. So for those reasons, we made sort of a compromise and decided we'd put our notes on from November 1st forward.
So there's no note archive that exists.
There isn't no note archive. It's possible at some point we might put them make them available going backwards. Of course, they are always available to a patient who wants to sign a release and get a paper copy of their record. That's available to everyone, everywhere, all the time.
But it's just a much more labor-intensive process now than being able to to go online and enter your password.
Very few actually do it unless there's a big question or a concern about the way the care is gone.
Well, Bruce McCarthy, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Dr. Bruce McCarthy is an internist and president of the Physician Division at Columbia St. Mary's Hospital. The hospital has recently launched a system called Open Notes, which gives patients access to their doctor's notes. Another break now, and then a public art project seeks to reinvigorate life in four Milwaukee neighborhoods. This is Like Effect from WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. From the iconic Mark de Suervo sculpture at the east end of Wisconsin Avenue to the more ephemeral, transitory pieces commissioned by the group Insight, Milwaukee is no stranger to public art. A project that played out throughout 2013 sought to accent the public in public art. Typeface included the input of residents in four distinct Milwaukee neighborhoods. And while the process is over, the art remains. Typeface is the collaboration between each neighborhood's residents, plus Milwaukee visual artist Reginald Baylor and multimedia producer Adam Carr. And the results really reflect the sum of their parts. Carr and Baylor joined Lake Effect's Bonnie North, and Baylor explained why he believes this project is different from other public art projects in the city.
This is unique because the concept of the art really was sort of integrated into the dialogue in the community and then installed. I think it's a little bit of the process and also the purpose of the public piece as well is generally different than if you just went to a sculpture garden and those works were conceived by the artist probably in their studio and then what they call plopped into place. I don't find either one of those more or less important, but I think this typeface project was on the end of integration.
There's four different sites that you worked on and created individual pieces or installations for. How did it all come to be?
We had the Joyce Foundation put out a request for proposals, and I was asked by Angela Diamani from Art Milwaukee to be the artist that would be involved in the proposal. And so we went to a discussion that was put together by Joyce Foundation and looked at the criteria and the requirements, and that's when the idea was conceived. And we were chiseled down to over 90 applicants throughout the Midwest. And then there was a final
small group
of maybe 15, and then four got chosen.
And from there, what was really great about working with the Joyce Foundation is, totally admittedly, our original proposal was kind of a process. We didn't have our neighborhoods narrowed down. We didn't say exactly what we were going to do. Mm-hmm. And the conversational processes were going to be tailored to each of the neighborhoods, so we couldn't even tell them exactly what that was. Mm-hmm. And they gave us, you know, after awarding us this grant, total freedom. I mean, there was no point at which, you know, they'd check in, but they wouldn't say, well, wouldn't you want to do this or that? And from there, you know, the way it worked, the Milwaukee community of funders really supported this project.
Yep.
So after we got the Joyce Foundation, we were able to use that, and we got all of this support from local funders. So we applied for a grant from the Joyce Foundation to do kind of a cool project, and what the funders in Milwaukee allowed us to do through their support was make something a lot bigger than what we originally had funded. So, and again, you know, we had complete freedom to create what we wanted to.
Right. So talk a little bit about what you created in these four neighborhoods. Let's list the neighborhoods first, and then what was the ideas behind them and how did they develop over time?
It's Harambe, Lindsay Heights, Sherman / Washington Park, and then Burnham Park on the south side. Mm-hmm. In each of those neighborhoods, I started with an exploration of the history, identity, and trajectory. So what my end goal was to create and implement a conversational process. I'm doing air quotes because that's who know what is a conversational process, you know? I wanted to do something in each neighborhood, not just a template. I wanted to do something that was informed by what that place is, what is the dialogue there, right? As well as what are the sites that we've picked? How are those in relationship having a conversation with their built environment?
Had you picked the sites before you started the conversations?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So you already knew where you wanted to be.
We got the neighborhoods. Yeah, we got the neighborhoods.
We actually, I think it started the first choice where we all agreed immediately was the Sherman Park.
Former Finney Library.
The Finney Library. That's the one we have to get that one.
Right. Because that was boarded up, right? That was the green panels.
Yes, that was the green panels. And again, the location, phenomenal. The familiarity of the location, history of the location. It was really nice to work with the city. Because it was city-owned property, and that was an experience that was phenomenal.
That's not usually a word that people use when they say they're working with the city government.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
And I think in a lot of ways, I mean, what are they going to do with all those green boards?
Right.
And they get that.
Right.
You know, they totally get that. Finney Library especially, as a statement, you know, those green boards just are the end of imagination. Mm-hmm. Finney Library used to be the beginning of the imagination of the Sherman Park and Washington Park community. Anyone that grew up around that neighborhood has a story of studying there or maybe falling in love there or whatever. It was a hub. So for us to come with an idea where we're not going to tear the building out of the ground, we're going to put on these boards a statement of the immense depth and texture of the creativity of the community surrounding this place, it didn't take as much convincing as we thought. The city was very supportive of that.
So obviously the residents were too, and in all of the neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one of the things that's so interesting about this is that people seemed very engaged in the idea of representing their neighborhoods in an interesting different way.
And that was a process too. I mean, so in each of the neighborhoods, we wanted to tailor a conversation there. So it wasn't just, hey, here's this. I'm here with a clipboard. I want to know about the following things. And at the end of the day, you're going to help us decide the shape of the smiley face we're drawing.
Which that's what I would have done. And that's when I knew to bring Adam in right away. Right after listening and thinking about the requirements of the Joyce Foundation project, I immediately thought, okay, there needs to be a lot of conversations. One-on-one, in-depth, honest, to provide a relaxed environment where people feel that you're not extracting things out for your own use. And that wasn't my gift. And I immediately, because of working with Adam previously, he was the guy to go do that. And you can hear it in his voice and how he took very seriously what he was hoping to happen.
Obviously, what people said to you made its way into the finished art that you put in all of these places. How much of it did you use and how much of it did you already have in mind going in? Was it a completely blank slate for you?
Yes.
Really?
Okay. There was no word that made it into the visuals that was not spoken by a resident. Then let me say that's actually a challenging thing because the statements weren't prepared by the residents for the public art project. They were a product of these conversations. Mm-hmm. You know, it was really hard to think about this. You know, it's not just you can go in and get language and this is who you are. You know, there isn't language representing people and communities that's exact in that way. So the fact that the process would have to be, you know, kind of an approximate process, I was fully aware of. So the question really was, how can we engage in relevant conversations that are open, sincere, and allow people to communicate, recognizing that we're outsiders coming in doing this project?
You know, when I received all the content, it was on, you know, printed on paper. And that to me became really just the color palette, to be honest with you.
They were shapes.
There were shapes. You use those to construct some type of visual eye candy. Or some visual attraction or something that's accessible or that someone wants to spend time with it. And that was really the ultimate goal I had prior to receiving the actual words or the statements or sentences, had determined what the structures were going to be, which was Burnham Park was a bouquet of flowers. And Sherman Library, we knew it was the green boards, and Lindsay Heights to do a free library. And then for Harambe to do the maze. Once I had decided on those structures, then it became how do we attach the language to the three-dimensional piece.
How have the residents responded to this, to all of them? Because they're four very different projects.
It's hard to tell, you know, because they're out in public. And like, admittedly, we don't have like a feedback form. I mean, what is the feedback form for something that's in public that hundreds of or thousands of people see a day? There's no such thing. You know, all of the books inside of the Little Free Library in Lindsay Heights as of this weekend were gone. So people are using them. Right. We've got to replenish that now.
That's right, because one of them is it's a library.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. An 18-door library. I think we started with about 400 books. So I guess 400 books are gone. Mm-hmm. That's a good thing. I hope some of them come back.
Well, and one thing we did prioritize is we put out 5,000 mailers that explain the projects in the immediate neighborhoods, just a really tight local mail to the addresses around each of the sites before the pieces were up. It was really important to us that we gave the neighborhood a first view and explanation of it, because it's very easy to see something in your neighborhood, wonder what it is, and never get an answer.
Now, to me, having conversation about public art is where the next ones are going. And, you know, the typeface, I believe, was a good testament to it happening and can happen and being supported by the community, the government, non-for-profits, profit sectors, all the way across the board. And again, I'm just very excited that the conversation is now, well, let's get 300 more communities. Works of art. Yeah.
Right. And more permanent
and
public
more
art. Because,
art.
I mean, people like Insight have been doing, you know, mm-hmm. these wonderful temporary right. installations right. for a long time,
right.
kind of on the same model,
sure.
but it's temporary.
Correct.
Yeah. Right. right. Which is the whole, I mean, it's a whole different way of looking
sure.
at it.
A combination yeah. of both would be great, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah
and I think one of the things about Typeface 2 is that it's a collection of voices of the contemporary time that exist in those neighborhoods that may not oftentimes have a platform to communicate in a public setting. I've seen some of the things that have been written about this as our art transforming neighborhoods or dying neighborhoods are not getting what we're trying to do. We're not saying these are dying neighborhoods. These neighborhoods are not dead. This project is about the life that exists in the neighborhood and just representing it without saying, you know, like I think it's an inherently hopeful gesture, but I think it's also, you know, we're just trying to give a platform for people to put language out and put expression and conversation out in public. And in some ways, I don't think, at least the nature of this project, that wouldn't really make sense for it to be permanent. Mm-hmm. I think they can have a life and maybe people will develop relationships with them, but they will come down and, you know, there will be new voices.
Well, they don't have to come down.
I was going to say they don't
That's
have
true.
To. They live.
They don't have to.
They live
yeah,
their normal lives,
down.
You know, whatever
yeah.
that is.
Maybe torn down like some of the biggest structures in the world. Some make it, some don't. I do like that it had happened and it is existing. And, you know, I think, again, a testament to why not multiply it.
And that's something we discussed is that each of the sites we picked, because it was underused, neglected, abandoned, foreclosed. And if someone moves into Finney Library and says, hey, we're starting up something here, we say, great, we're coming off the windows. Can we come inside? You know, if something gets built across the street from Shiloh Tabernacle and Harambe, you know, there's plans for it. Great. We will move puzzled and amazed, you know. So we would be happy to clear out the spaces that we're currently occupying. And obviously yeah. we'd like to integrate them into whatever happens next. But, you know, there's certainly more spaces to use. So
people always say, can artists change communities? I want to assume for a minute that the answer is absolutely yes. Of course, mm-hmm. artists change communities just like anybody can change a community. Mm-hmm. But taking that assumption that the answer is yes, how did you want to change these communities? Or did you?
Because each of the communities that we were active in, I don't live in. And I think what was beautiful about this is how do I know that anyone in the community wants me to change and exactly what do they want me to change? For me, to participate in being in the community, having dialogue in that community, if it weren't for these projects, I would not have met the people I have met. So I think where I'm effective to change is, you know, really going into the community and being an honest, say, neighbor and saying I'm from Milwaukee and I grew up on this street. And it was interesting, a lot of the dialogue and a lot of the statements and content that was made by the community were very familiar to me in remembering the communities I grew up in. Because a lot of the dialogue, like Adam said, was about hope. It ended up being very, there was a lot of wisdom. Reading it, I felt that I was reading wisdom, and it was from young to the elderly community. And so changing a community is really how we interact with each other. And you interact with each other and you start having conversations, then the buildings and the parks and the schools and all that tangible stuff just starts to grow. So I don't know if artists can change communities as opposed to artists can, possibly just be integrated in the community and provide some beauty and some hope.
And I think, you know, we worked with these spaces that were abandoned or neglected. And, you know, what those spaces say to a person who lives around them, who engages with them is, you know, it can stunt the imagination, can stunt the notion of possibility there, mm-hmm. both within that environment and within oneself. So I think the act of taking conversation, taking dialogue from people's, you know, these really felt, this felt language, you know, this connotative language and putting it in those spaces, I want people to spend time with them. Like the house at Lindsay Heights, the longer I spend with each of these pieces, the more I like that one because there's the most to read there. And the conversation is very real and there's conflict in it and there's turmoil, but there's also a lot of beauty and hope and joy. To just represent that in public, especially right there on Center and Titonia, mm-hmm. where what is the news about there when you hear about something, you know? And this is a much more nuanced look at the people who live there and who have lives there. It's not, you know, just to take away the focus from any kind of conflict and just represent the beauty of the fact that lives are happening and there's just this infinite humanity there is really what I was hoping to put out in public.
It also sounds like you both have connections to these communities that you didn't have before.
Oh, absolutely. I've just kind of ran around the city of Milwaukee a bunch in my work, but this was a chance to hunker down a little mm-hmm. bit more closely mm-hmm. and to really look at that. You know, like Sherman Park's a really big place. Mm-hmm. You know, saying, you know, Sherman Park does have some kind of an identity, but, you know, what are, when you start thinking about it, like, well, how are people connected? Sometimes people think of their neighborhood as mm-hmm. the two houses next to them or right. maybe the house they're in. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people will think of like, oh, I'm part of this big thing. Mm-hmm. So it did challenge me to think a lot about what I thought of as these communities, how cohesive they are, and just kind of this nebulous web of networks and individuals and relationships that exist there.
Adam and Reggie, thanks again so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Adam Carr and Reginald Baylor are the creators of Typeface, public art project in the Layton Boulevard West, Sherman Park, Lindsay Heights, and Harambe neighborhoods. They spoke with Bonnie North. The art process is completed, but the art is still viewable, and there's a link to more about the project from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. After an interesting regular season, it's difficult to tell which is more unexpected, that the Packers are in the playoffs or that it's been easy to get tickets to Lambeau for the game. Our sports contributor offers his take on both issues when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tyke. The note on my interview calendar kind of sums up the situation. We were planning on checking in with our sports guy, Howie Magner, on the Packers season sometime around now. And my notation, written sometime last year, reads, playoff preview or post-mortem? Well, it was a close one, but Howie joins us for that playoff preview and to talk about the most unusual part of the story, that the Packers have had a hard time selling out the game. Howie, nice to see you.
Thanks, Mitch. It's always a pleasure to be here.
So the lead sports story in the area has kind of been a business story lately. Forget for a moment the idea that the Packers might be blacked out on television. Why are there tickets left for a Packers playoff game at all?
I think the last figure that I saw Thursday morning was there were about 5,500 tickets left available. And I think it is surprising on the face of it because you hear the Green Bay Packers, they have this 50-year-long waiting list to get season tickets, and here they can't sell 77,000 tickets. But I think there's some contributing factors. One, they just, you know, the stadium expansion is taking effect right now. So there's more tickets to sell than usual, or at least than there have been in the past for playoff games. Two, the weather is just going to be brutal. The latest that I saw was they were expecting a temperature of -5 and a wind chill in the neighborhood of -20. People are already calling it the next ice bowl up there.
But this is Packers weather.
Well, that is true. But there's Packers weather, and then there's ridiculous Packers weather. And I think this is bordering on the verge of ridiculous Packers weather, or perhaps even going overboard. So I think that's a factor as well. And then you also have the aspect of the Packers just squeaked into the playoffs, and there's maybe some real wonderment or concern about whether or not they'll be able to beat the San Francisco 49ers. So I think you combine the weather with maybe people not necessarily believing that the Packers are going to win the game. And it's also, I believe, the last game on Sunday. So if you're, you know, driving up there from Milwaukee, you're not getting back until late at night and you're frozen solid and you've got to get up and go to work the next day. I think there's just a lot of things that are working against it. Having said all of that, even if they don't sell out the game to, you know, regular paying fans, I can't imagine that the game will be blacked out in the state of Wisconsin. They're just not going to let it happen. There's some business or some corporate sponsor out there somewhere that will buy up whatever, you know, number of tickets is left and either distribute them freely or do some type of promotion or something.
And this is not a stadium that's going to look half empty on
TV.
No,
not at all. I mean, it's going to look fine on TV. But I think the main concern with people is, A, there's the Packers mystique. They always sell out. And, B, they're worried that the game will be blacked out. A playoff game will be blacked out across Wisconsin. It's just not going to happen. They're not going to let it happen. It would be a PR disaster. Some solution will be, come up with to make sure that if you are sitting at your home in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, on Sunday afternoon, you will be able to watch the Green Bay Packers play their playoff game.
And I did look at the official ticket selling site, at Packers.com. The cheapest seats are $100, which, I can't tell. The NFL being the NFL, that's either an outrageous amount or really not all that bad for an NFL playoff game.
Yeah, I don't think that's exorbitant, particularly for a playoff game, particularly with a matchup like the Packers and the 49ers. To be honest, would I want to pay $100 to sit in -5-degree weather? It wouldn't necessarily be my first choice of a way to spend a Sunday afternoon, but then I'm also not a diehard Green Bay Packers fan who grew up with this type of thing. So people will make their decision, and I think they'll get closer. I don't know that they'll necessarily sell it out, but again, I think there'll be some business out there or the Packers themselves that will buy up the remaining tickets, and you'll be able to watch it on TV.
All right. So let's talk about how the Packers actually got to this point, because not long ago we were talking about the Packers and there were really a lot of question marks about this team. Aaron Rodgers is back at quarterback. Are there fewer question marks about this team as they take on the 49ers?
I think it's fair to say there are fewer, and Aaron Rodgers erases a lot of those question marks, not only by playing but showing against Chicago that he was close to his level of normal play. He wasn't perfect. He didn't look like the Aaron Rodgers of old. He was overthrowing quite a few receivers. He threw the two interceptions, which are uncharacteristic. I don't know how many multiple interception games he's had, but it's not a lot. I want to say it's below double digits for his career.
But he has not had a lot of times where he's just coming back after being out for a couple months.
That's the thing. He missed half the season. I mean, the guy hadn't thrown a pass against, you know, real competition for half a football season. So you expect that he's not going to pop in and be his normal self. Having said that, as the game went on, he certainly appeared to get closer to his normal self. And, of course, he ended it with that great play at the end that got them the touchdown on the 4th and 8. There were several things going on with that play, and Packers fans no doubt have seen it. But avoiding the blitz, rolling to his left, and then having to throw, you know, basically off his back foot to get the ball 50 yards downfield to Randall Cobb, who also made a triumphant comeback, It was a pretty amazing feat, and I don't know that there are many quarterbacks in the league that could do that, especially if they're coming off a broken collarbone. So he certainly makes them an entirely different team, and Randall Cobb adds a lot to this team as well. I think people kind of overlooked the absence of Randall Cobb because everybody was focusing on the absence of Aaron Rodgers, and you have both of those guys back, and it really takes the offense up a notch. Having said all of that, the only reason the Packers are in the playoffs is because the rest of their division stunk. I mean, the Lions probably had they were the healthiest team in the division all year. And frankly, not making the playoffs got their coach fired, and many would say deservedly so because they should have won it. And then the Bears, they were right there, and, you know, they were healthier than the Packers were, and they couldn't get the job done.
Interesting that the Bears then went ahead and rewarded their quarterback with a 7-year contract extension.
Jay Cutler has a new long-term contract, and frankly, it sounds like Packers fans are happier about that than Bears fans are. So we'll see how that plays out. But, you know, when you see a quarterback like Jay Cutler, who's not a bad quarterback, I consider him an above-average quarterback, but when you see him getting guaranteed money, I think it's going to be in the $50 million range. I think the first 3 years of the deal is going to be an average of $18 million a year. And you look at Aaron Rodgers, it really should just make you appreciate, as a Packers fan, everything that you have in Aaron Rodgers. Because if a guy like Jay Cutler is getting $18 million a year, I don't know what price you would have to pay Aaron Rodgers before he's not a bargain for your team. So the Packers are, many would say, fortunate. A lot of things had to come together for them to get to this point. Don't forget Matt Flynn. They're not in the playoffs if it weren't for Matt Flynn somehow, after playing for, you know, two other teams this year, bouncing around, getting cut by those teams, ending up back in Green Bay and basically saving their season by pulling out the tie against Minnesota and then another win. So the Dallas game, which is an unbelievable comeback. So a lot of things had to come together for them to be in this position. And in many ways, it kind of reminds you of 2010, when a lot of things were going against the Packers. A lot of things had to come together, and they got hot at the right time and went on this unbelievable run in the playoffs. There's nothing that says it can't happen again. It won't be easy, certainly against a 49ers team that the Packers have not had any luck against in recent years. But the simple fact that Aaron Rodgers is back and that things seem to be coming together at the right time has to give Packers fans hope.
At the same time, the 49ers are not the Chicago Bears.
No, they're not. They're a much better team. They're 12-4. They've certainly performed better than the Packers have through this. The interesting thing about the Packers, all regular season, they did not beat a playoff team, a team that's in the playoffs. Their best win came against teams that finished the season with an 8-8 record. The 49ers come in at 12-4. All four of their losses came to teams that will be in the playoffs. They beat two playoff teams along the way, the Packers being one of them, the Seattle Seahawks being the other. So I think you can safely say that San Francisco comes in with the better playoff resume. They've also got Colin Kaepernick, who has given the Packers fits the last two times that they've played him. And he's done it two different ways. The playoff game last year, he ran all over them. The opener this year, he threw all over them for more than 400 yards. So the Packers are going to have to find a way to not necessarily stop Kaepernick, but certainly slow him down. And it's a job made all the more difficult by not having Clay Matthews on defense. He's going to miss the game with his injured thumb. The Packers' defense, while it's played better, and it's played better recently because they forced more turnovers than they had earlier in this season, it's still a very tough task. One of the things that I think plays in Green Bay's favor, however, is you think back to the opener, the San Francisco 49ers, I think, held the ball for 17 minutes longer than the Packers did in that opener. That's a huge difference in time of possession. The emergence of Eddie Lacy and the Packers running game as a whole should help shrink that gap a little bit. Lacy only ran for, I think it was 41 yards in the season opener. He's really developed, and the Packers running game has really developed as the season has gone along. So that's a difference that Packers fans can look at and say, well, maybe that will help close the gap a little bit.
Weather might be a difference between the opening game of the season and this weekend.
It certainly gets cold at night sometimes in San Francisco, but nothing like this. There are those who believe that it won't affect San Francisco Francisco as much as it might affect another warm weather team, because San Francisco relies a lot on their running game. They've got Frank Gore, and so that tends to rise when it gets down to cold weather. You know, it certainly has. If you were looking at the weather favoring one team over the other, you would think that it would favor the Packers over the 49ers. And, you know, for all the talk of San Francisco having dominated Green Bay recently, they've done it out in San Francisco. They haven't played the Packers here the last two games. And so that's something in their favor.
Should be an exciting game.
Absolutely.
Howie, thanks.
All right. Thanks, Mitch. Take care.
Howie Magner writes the Sports Nut column for Milwaukee Magazine's website, and he is senior editor at the magazine. He's also our regular sports contributor. In case you'd forgotten, the Packers play the 49ers Sunday afternoon at Lambeau Field in the first round of the playoffs. That's Friday's edition of the show, produced by Dan Harmon, Bonnie North, and Stephanie Lecce, with the assistance of Catherine Buggs, Eleanor Peterson, and Nathan Royster, and the web support of Michelle Matternowski. I'm Mitch Teich. Stay warm this weekend, and I hope you'll spend some time with us tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.